I did sever ties with the person that I've been talking to in Hamas for the last 17 years. And I did that because he is no longer the same person that I spoke to for the last 17 years and negotiated not only the release of the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit in 2011, but also continued talking with him and achieved two ceasefires in our careers together, and have been negotiating long-term extended ceasefires and release of other hostages in Gaza. But Ghazi Hamad, who was the Hamas spokesperson recently, he's been the Minister of Social Welfare in Gaza. He has left Gaza. He's in Beirut. He is the primary spokesperson of the Hamas's war that they waged on Israel. And he has justified the killing of children and women and elderly people and threatened Israel that we will have repeated October 7th over and over again, a million times, he said.
And you've written this very powerful letter to him where you explain, you set out your thought processes there. I mean, give us a sense of how you've been communicating with Hamas since October the 7th and how they've reacted to what's unfolded since.
Well, immediately when the war broke out, I made contact with several people in Hamas, understanding that they had already taken hostages. We didn't know that they would have 240 hostages. We also didn't know that they would brutally murder 1,400 people in Israel, the majority, the overwhelming majority of them being innocent civilians, babies, children, elderly people, just a human tragedy what they did. But as soon as I understood that there were hostages involved, I contacted several people in Hamas trying to propose an immediate release of women, children, and elderly people. And I collected data and understood that there were 43 Palestinian women prisoners in Israel and 190 minors, 17, 16, 15-year-olds, most of whom had thrown stones at Israeli soldiers or Molotov cocktails, all from the West Bank. And I knew that something like that, in exchange for women, children, and elderly people, we could get support for doing in Israel. And I thought it had to be done as soon as possible. So I appealed to them. I understood that there were no talks. I understood that one of the things that I could do was help to create as direct links as possible to the potential negotiators. And here it was very clear from day one, we're talking about Qatar and Egypt as the potential third parties. And I was immediately in contact with people in Qatar and in Egypt and tried to make sure there were as direct links to Israel as possible as with Hamas.
Given that you secured the release of the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit in return for over 1,000 Palestinian soldiers, the sheer number of hostages now being taken by Hamas means that that kind of arithmetic no longer adds up, does it?
The arithmetic doesn't add up in any way. There are a total of about 7,000 Palestinians in Israeli jails, including those arrested since October 7th. Close to 1,000 of them are administrative detainees, which means they've been arrested without charge and imprisoned without conviction. 559 of the 7,000 are people who have murdered Israelis and are serving life sentences or multiple life sentences. 20 to 30% of the prisoners are from Hamas, the rest are not. Only 300 to 400 of them are from Gaza, the majority are from the West Bank. So there are big questions involved here. Is a negotiated agreement for the release of hostages possible? If it is possible, Hamas has already made its demands that it's all for all the hostages for all the prisoners. Is there an Israeli government that could agree to something like that? Would Hamas agree that it's all done in one release? Because Israel would definitely not agree for it to be parceled out over a period of time. It would have to be at one time. And then the question is, what do you do with the 7,000 prisoners who are released? Would they be allowed to go back to their homes and continue to attack Israelis? Right now, the war, the existence of the hostages is preventing Israel from going into the tunnels where most of the Hamas fighters are, where the Hamas command centers are, where most of their weapons are, because right now the hostages would be in harm's way. They would be between the Israeli army and the Hamas fighters, and Israel doesn't want to put them in harm's way. I know that other pressure is on For instance, Hamas very much wants a ceasefire, and the government of Israel has just emphasized that there would be no ceasefire until hostages are released.
Yeah, but is there any prospect of that happening? I mean, it seems a kind of hopeless situation that you set out. You know, clearly Israel isn't going to agree to release any number of Palestinian prisoners. And yet, you know, you can't see Hamas releasing any more than just a few hostages as they've done already.
I think that the clock is ticking on the future of this hostage issue, because there will come a time when Israel will make a decision to go in the tunnels. They have the technology and the means to do it. They have a plan to do it, to limit the casualties to Israeli soldiers. The hostages may be sacrificed by that decision. That would be a human tragedy, and it would be an irresponsible thing for the government of Israel to do. Israel has a moral responsibility to bring the hostages home because Israel failed to protect them on October 7th. Israel's primary job as a country, like every country, is to provide security for their citizens, and Israel failed in that task.
But can you see any scenario in which Hamas, in that very small window before Israel goes into those tunnels, can you see any scenario where Hamas releases a large number of hostages?
I think it is possible. I think that we have to increase the pressure on Hamas to do that. I know that Secretary Blinken is here now in Jerusalem, or in Israel, actually in Tel Aviv, pushing the Israeli government to increase the amount of humanitarian aid getting into Gaza. I think that the Israeli government has told Mr. Blinken and President Biden that we want to deliver aid to the people of Gaza. We will not stop it. We will even contribute to the aid going into food and medical supplies and water, but only after hostages are released. Now is the time to squeeze Hamas, to put that pressure on Hamas. They have a responsibility to the people of Gaza. They have taken the Palestinian people back 75 years, and this pressure needs to be increased on Hamas. At the same time, the families of the hostages are putting pressure on Israel to make the deal of all for all. And that's also happening in parallel at the same time. Many of the families of the hostages are camped out in front of the Ministry of Defense in Tel Aviv, where the Israeli war cabinet is meeting, and calling on the government of Israel to make the deal of all for all.
In your communications with Hamas, do you get a sense that they might move towards a large release of hostages? Do you think, you know, you said that was, it was a, there was a small possibility, you said. What are you hearing?
First of all, in the last 4.5 days, they've been radio silent with me. They haven't communicated with me, which in the past was a sign that something serious and intensive is going on. I hope it's the case now. My own sense is that the Qatari channel, which is where the Americans have put most of their emphasis, is not the right place to make the deal. It's much more likely to happen in Cairo, where the Egyptian intelligence has a direct link to the people underground in the tunnels. The Qataris have a link to the political leadership of Hamas that are sitting in Doha, and I think they're disconnected from the reality on the ground. But I think that there are intensive talks going on, and as long as the talks are going on, there's a hope.
And in terms of the other side of the deal, the all for all that you were talking about, the release of the Palestinian prisoners, that seems much less likely.
It seems very unlikely, primarily because Prime Minister Netanyahu is so weak at this time. If he was stronger, if he had a better moral code and was more interested with the long-term welfare of the country and less concerned with his own personal welfare, the chances are that he would demonstrate the moral courage that he did in making the decision to bring the Israeli soldier home in 2011.
One of the very striking things in your letter is your criticism of the lifestyle that some of the leaders of Hamas lead. Give me a sense of that gap between the Hamas leadership and the people in Gaza.
Ismail Haniyeh, who's the political leader of Hamas, grew up in a refugee camp in Gaza and built a mansion inside the refugee camp, and then several years ago left Gaza and has been living it up in Doha, in Qatar, along with Khaled Mashal and Musa Abu Marzouk, and even the number two political leader in Gaza, Khalil Haya, who's the deputy of Yahya Sinwar, the political leader of Hamas, who's directly responsible for this tragedy that we're in, is in Doha, living it up in the five-star hotels, protected by Qatari bodyguards, flying in private jets around the world. I mean, and you look at the horrendous poverty. 80% of the people living in Gaza live under the poverty line. And you see these people who are called leaders living it up outside, running away before the war happened. My co-negotiator, Razi Hamad, escaped Gaza 2 months ago and has been in Beirut all this time, not even with his people. And when I asked him, when I heard that his house was bombed by Israel, how is his family? I learned that his family is with him in Beirut.
Do you think they deserve Hamas to be wiped out?
I think they do. I think that Hamas lost its right to continue to govern Gaza. Let's remember that there haven't been elections since 2006. Not only have the elections not taken place with the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, but Hamas has prevented elections in Gaza. They were elected once in a kind of democracy that exists one time and one time only.
And just finally and briefly, if you would, a lot of people listening to all of this just hear a kind of hopelessness. Do you see any way out of this conflict, any way out of this protracted bloodshed?
I am hoping, it's a very big hope, that the day after tomorrow, I don't even call it the day after tomorrow, we will wake up from the reality where the Israelis have experienced the biggest trauma since the Holocaust. And not only were those people killed and hostages taken, but we lost our sense of security. That's our trauma. The Palestinians' trauma is the biggest trauma they're experiencing since the Nakba, the catastrophe of 1948. And I hope when we wake up, we're going to do two things. We're going to hold our leaders accountable for where they brought us, and we will wake up with a new generation that will say no more. We will have what I've been calling metaphorically our Belfast moment. But there was a moment when the people in Northern Ireland stood up and said no more. We've been killing each other for too long. Let's figure out how to live together. And that's what has to happen here.
Gershon Baskin, thank you very much for joining us.